creation. Woman of fantasy. Woman I need my life like a string. I can't take the on and off thing. I am.
On WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton, this is Danya Heffley with your WSLR news headlines for Wednesday, October 1st. The federal government shutdown directly impacts only a limited number of federal employees in the Sarasota-Bradenton area, but it could have wider effects on the local community, particularly if it is prolonged. Unpaid air traffic controllers could lead to potential flight disruptions at Sarasota-Bradenton International Airport. Frozen funding for the National Flood Insurance Program could delay real estate transactions by halting new flood insurance policies. Essential social safety net programs such as SNAP and WIC food benefit could experience funding shortages. And although Social Security and Medicare checks will likely continue, new applications could face significant delays. The local economy, which relies heavily on tourism, could also suffer from the broader uncertainty and travel disruptions. Federal loan processing for housing and small businesses may be halted, and crucial scientific and environmental monitoring for coastal issues could be suspended. The University of South Florida has named Moaz Lamayum as the only finalist in its search for a new president. He's an academic with strong ties to the Tampa Bay region. He's now president of the University of North Florida. Before that, he was dean of USF's College of Business for 10 years. He holds a PhD in information systems and has spent his career in higher education. As dean, he raised more than $126 million in donations. His appointment must still be approved by USF Board of Trustees and the State Board of Governors. Florida's six-week abortion ban took effect in May 2024. Since then, the number of abortions in the state has dropped by 27%, about 12,000 fewer cases. That's the largest decline seen in any state, according to the Guttmacher Institute. Nationwide, travel for out-of-state abortions has also dipped, likely because funding for abortion support groups has gone down. Another study found birth rates have risen in states with six-week abortion bans. The rise is most noticeable among women of color, women on Medicaid, and unmarried women. Three board members have left the Hope Florida Foundation, a charity run by the state's Department of Children and Families and spearheaded by First Lady Casey DeSantis. They were not reappointed after raising questions about a controversial $10 million transfer. The transfer is now under criminal investigation and could put the foundation's nonprofit status at risk. This has been Danya Heffley with your WSLR news headlines for Wednesday, October 1st.
Good morning and welcome to the Peace and Justice Report. I'm Tom Walker. Bob Connors is here on alternate weeks. And I want to remind you that the views expressed on this program and other WSLR programs expressed by us hosts, the guests, or callers are their own opinions and not necessarily those of WSLR, its staff, or volunteers. I want to remind you that on Wednesday, October 5th, 15th, we'll start a one-week fall membership drive, and I hope everybody listening will join us on that day and consider rejoining or joining for the first time WSLR. Your $40 for the year will get you reduced price tickets, and that's all it takes to become a member. And I know you appreciate having a non-commercial community station here, and that's twice a year. That's the way you get to show it. Right now, we're still in the temporary studio. We're renovating the major studio, and John Dickman is helping us out. And I want to tell you that our guest today is Alan Mestel. Alan is a photojournalist and a documentary photographer based in Bradenton. Originally from Canada, he spent many years in Toronto's advertising industry, where he directed and photographed national and international TV commercials for major advertising agencies, and his work has earned numerous accolades and awards. And then in 2014, Alan relocated to Florida, where he shifted his focus from photojournalism and documentary photography. He opened a commercial photography studio in Brandon and also began capturing very powerful images that have been featured in exhibitions across the United States, Europe, and the United Kingdom. His work primarily involves human rights and social justice, and often highlights the plights of migrants and refugees. Notably, he has documented the migrants' crisis at the U.S.-Mexico border. He's documented the refugee situation and war in Ukraine, and his photographs have been published in major media outlets such as USA Today, CNN, and NBC and PBS. His photography aims to tell untold stories of conflict, grief, and resilience. He's been traveling extensively to capture these narratives, including trips to the U.S.-Mexico border, cities in the United States with various political protests, and Uvalde, Texas, after the massacre there. And his work serves not only as a visual reference, but also a call to action, urging viewers to empathize with this human suffering. He recently returned from his fourth trip to Ukraine, documenting the war there and from the front lines. Alan's work will be on exhibit in Fogartyville starting October 13th. We invite you to come see that work. There will be a reception at 6 p.m. on October 28th, and you can talk to Alan about his work. And then after that, at 7 o'clock, we'll be showing a film called 20 Days in Mariupol, which is a powerful movie about the first days of the war, shot live by a cameraman who barely made it out of there. So it's an amazing movie, and you can come see that again on October 28th. His photography can be viewed at his website, alanmestel.com. That's alanmestel.com. So, welcome, Alan.
Thank you.
Glad you're here.
Appreciate it. Glad to be here.
Is he going up?
Yeah, I'm
going
to bring him up.
Check his levels. Stay the
same. Don't tell me what to do, please.
Okay.
Go ahead, Alan.
How's that?
Okay, we're checking the mic levels. So, Alan,
yeah.
What attracted you to photography in the first place, and what led you to turn from commercial photography to photojournalism?
That's an interesting story, actually. Well, my father, was a cinematographer.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, my father and my brother were both very, very, very renowned cinematographers. Anyway, my father used to bring me back short ends of film from commercial shoots that he did when I was a kid. I was like 11, 12 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I would load those into cassettes, and I took possession of my mother's Kodak Brownie camera.
Uh-huh.
And, I would develop and print my own photographs in my grandmother's hall closet, which I repurposed as a darkroom. So it was my first love. And in terms of getting into the film industry, the commercial production industry, that happened really because my dad was in it, and it was I sort of just took advantage of the opportunity of him being able to sort of direct me towards work, and so I went that route. But photography was always my hobby and my passion, and it wasn't until I left the advertising industry back in 2014 and came down here that I decided that I was going to pursue still photography as a profession, and I'm really glad I did. In fact, I kind of wish I'd done it earlier now.
Well, what made you make the change?
Just because I was done with the ad industry, and there isn't really an advertising the type of work that I was doing isn't available in South Florida. We really moved down here because my wife wanted to live in the warmth, And so it was just an opportunity for me to transition from something that I had always loved but never done professionally into something that would be and I had never imagined how much I would take to the photojournalism and the documentary photography. It was something that I just started really because of the political situation here in the U.S. and just became obsessed with. Honestly, it's become a real passion.
Do you do that? Well, you can't do that full time because you've got a commercial studio.
Well, I mean, there's that balance between what I do professionally for compensation, and I do make money with the photojournalism. I make more money from the commercial from the commercial work, but it's a balance, and I try and keep myself as busy as I can with both aspects of the business.
Okay, well, let's talk about some of the places you've visited to do your work. I know there have been several. Talk about some of them, the border and the Uvalde, and then we'll talk about Ukraine.
Sure. I became involved with some activists that were doing work on migrants' rights issues. I actually met them here in Florida at Homestead. When there was a protest outside the Homestead Air Force Base, which was a detention center for minors, and it's a group called Witness at the Border, and working in conjunction with them, documenting their activities, I ended up traveling almost the entire length of the U.S.-Mexico border, both sides of the border, documenting migrant issues in refugee camps and migrant camps in northern Mexico. And documenting their journey, the journey of migrants in the U.S. as well. I was in Uvalde, Texas, just the day after the shooting there.
Wow!
I just happened to be in Texas at the time, working on some migrant issues when that shooting happened, and I drove up there and documented that.
Wow. Then talk about Ukraine. I think first you went to document the refugees.
Yeah.
Talk about that. How do you decide to do it there?
there is a family connection. My grandfather was Ukrainian.
Oh.
Yeah. Wow. My father's father. Although he left in the 1930s, I guess, went to the UK. Uh-huh. So I've always had a connection to Ukraine. As with everyone else, we watched the military build up of the Russian forces on the border, and just with horror, hoping that it was all a bluff and that somehow Putin was going to back down, and he didn't, and so I was. I was literally at the Polish-Ukrainian border March of 2022, which was just less than two weeks after the invasion.
Wow. I remember those photographs.
Yeah. It was very hard to get my head around to see something on the scale of what I would have imagined World War II was like. I mean, literally thousands of people pouring across the border with whatever they could carry, pushing shopping carts with their belongings, and shell shocked and with nothing, abandoning all of their belongings and their homes, of course, the men were prohibited at that time because of martial law from leaving the country, so it was mostly, almost exclusively women and children.
Uh-huh.
A remarkable experience. Not only seeing the refugee exodus, but also seeing the massive, decentralized, non-governmental aid response that happened. I mean, people were coming literally from all over the world, but particularly Europe.
Wow.
Just driving to the border with whatever supplies they would pack into vehicles and setting up soup kitchens and right at the border. As with everything that I've seen, obviously I've seen a lot of human tragedy and a lot of people in crisis. But the flip side of that is that you do get the opportunity to see people at their best. People
sure.
who who sacrifice their time, their energy, their money, their resources to be able to try and provide comfort and aid to people who are in those dire circumstances. And that can be uplifting, for sure.
Were you prohibited at that point from going in, or did
start? I could have at that time. In fact, I tried to. The aid group that I was going with, I had. They said, "Well, if you can get back here before we cross, we'll take you." But I had to get my passport from my car, and by the time I got back, they had gone through.
So I
didn't actually cross into Ukraine proper until I went back. That's in July of that year.
So your second trip, you went in.
Yeah.
And where did you go then? What did you concentrate on then?
Well, I mean, then again, I went in with an aid group called the Renegade Refugee Runners, and they were providing support to civilians in the military, providing supplies, and basically traveled from Lviv down to Odessa, photographed the situation, moved from there up to Kyiv, Mykolaiv and Kyiv. In all of my trips into Ukraine, I covered a lot of territory, a lot of ground, mm-hmm. primarily, certainly laterally in the east, mm-hmm. in the combat zone. It's just every time I go, I feel like I'm leaving too soon and start making plans to go back.
I guess there was always shelling, right?
All over
the country.
Yeah, I mean the drone attacks and the glide bombs and the cruise missiles to some degree, concentrated mainly in the east. But yeah, I mean there was missile attacks in Odessa when I was there. There was missile attacks in Venezia, which is in the center of the country when I was there. Nowhere is entirely safe. And certainly laterally in the last few weeks, everything's stepped up a notch and Putin's been attacking the whole country. But obviously primarily the danger is the closer you get to, they have what they call the yellow zone, then the red zone, which is the combat zone, and then the zero line, which is the line of contact. So I did spend some time at the zero line, although the army is reluctant to let journalists get to put too much in harm's way. But certainly spent a lot of time in the red zone, which is sort of that 20 kilometers from the zero line where they're, you
had a companion on at least one of the trips. What was his name? I didn't write it down.
I've had different assistants when I've been over there. I did go over once with another photographer by the name of David Graham. Yeah, that was in the summer of 23. We went there. Subsequently, I have hired fixers. In 24 and this last trip in – that's actually my fifth time was in May of this year.
Oh, fifth time. Yeah. Wow.
I went on behalf of an organization called United Help Ukraine, which is one of the larger nonprofits that is providing aid, enormous amounts of aid. They're an incredible organization. They're based in D.C. They are a group of women who met during the protests against the invasion of Crimea in 2014. They were D.C. residents, and they met and formed this nonprofit and have done an incredible job of providing aid since 2014. So they've been operating for over 10 years now. And they sponsored and paid for the last two trips, and I photographed their programs. They have a huge number of programs supporting both the military and civilian population, doing a huge number of really, really admirable work.
Our Rotary Club also has some projects over there.
Mm-hmm.
Spotlight Ukraine is the other.
Yeah, Spotlight Ukraine, run by Christine Mariconda, who's a resident of Sarasota. She is um, started a basically it's an awareness project where she is trying to generate, I guess, good press for Ukraine, trying to keep people in the country engaged in what's happening over there. Her website, Spotlight Ukraine, provides information, stories, blog posts about, you know, various individuals and organizations that are working in Ukraine, highlighting people of interest, some of the people that I photographed, some of the mm-hmm. programs that I photographed. Mm-hmm. She's written about these things. And again, the idea is just to try to make sure that information, valid and verifiable information about what's happening in the country, is being made available to citizens of the United States. Hmm.
So that's UnitedHelpUkraine.org,
yep.
And SpotlightUkraine.com, yep. I believe. Talk about some of your most moving encounters while you were there. I know there was one in Izium.
In Izium, the first time that I was taken there, was actually taken by a firefighter that we met at a roadside coffee stand. And we went back to the fire station, photographed the firefighters there. And then one of the guys basically said, I got something to show you. And we followed him, didn't know where we were going, and drove down this dirt road into the woods. And, about a mile into the woods, all of a sudden we just started seeing these open graves. And it was a spot where the Russians had massacred and buried, I think, over 450 Ukrainians during the occupation, and buried them in unmarked graves in the woods. And I'd never seen anything like it. It was something that you would have imagined would have perhaps been, something that would have happened during the Second World War. But the fact that it happened just, short weeks after the invasion was, and seeing all the graves had been exhumed, and they were doing their best to identify the people that had been, but so that was, over 450 open graves, just marked with simple wooden crosses, just with a number on them. And some of the markers had been family members had come and memorialized their loved ones by putting, more elaborate markers in these open graves. But it was a very difficult thing to see.
There were probably markers and memorials all over the country, right?
All over the country. I mean, on the highway between Lviv and Kyiv, which was I came across a number of different just roadside memorials, usually graves with mm-hmm. with multiple people in them that had been killed during the early days of the invasion and had just been buried by the side of the road. And
wow,
that's common. There's now a fairly extensive memorial in Bucha, memorializing the massacre in Bucha when civilians had been massacred and left in the streets, with their hands bound. And it's pretty heart-wrenching to read the names and the dates mm-hmm. of birth of the people, because I saw a child as young as two that mm-hmm. was on that, and I saw multiple people in their 90s. So they literally, the massacre, the civilian massacre, was comprehensive, and nobody was spared. Mm-hmm. And, there were other things that I saw that I found really difficult to photograph. The last time in May of this year when I was there, I met a guy whose home had been hit by a Shahid drone and was destroyed. And his wife, 28 years old, her name was Anna, when the drone hit, she had thrown herself on top of their six-year-old son mm-hmm. to protect him. And the boy had survived, but she was killed.
Wow.
And she had died protecting her boy. And I photographed him in his home, I think it was 2 or 3 days after that had happened, and it was a very difficult thing to do.
And you took a photograph with his permission, of course,
Of course, yeah.
And is that story connected to the photograph at all, or people would have to
Right, not at the moment, but I think I will probably put a photograph of him in the exhibition, and the story will be there.
A note about that.
Yeah, a note about it, yeah.
So how do you – I have no idea how you go about approaching someone or deciding on – someone and you ask their permission? Do they pose? Do you take a candid shot?
No, usually, I mean, I try to, I do portraits, do a lot of just sort of candid photojournalistic style imagery. In terms of how I work, I mean, it's, it varies depending on the situation.
Uh-huh.
You know, if it's an active situation, you know, I photographed the firefighters working on a blaze.
Right.
For a drone that had hit a building, as fortunately an unoccupied building in Kramatorsk when I was there last year. So obviously that's just a matter of, you know, running around and photographing people as they work. In other situations, I'll be talking to somebody that I've been introduced to or that I've met in a particular situation, and you know, I will ask, you know, is it okay if I photograph you or,
right.
You know, there's no one.
No one way to approach it.
You know, there's no one set of protocols. It just depending on the situation. It varies.
Hmm. And do you show them what the photo you took? Do you
sometimes, yeah, if they want to. Absolutely.
Huh.
And most people are quite happy to be photographed. I think everyone in Ukraine recognizes the value of
of
being able to show to the world and to the U.S. specifically the reality of what's happening there. Everybody recognizes that ultimately it can only help. So you know it hasn't generally ever been an issue. As I said, it's not like people are unwilling to be photographed.
Has you ever considered putting your photos on the road, so to speak, with a traveling show? Or?
Well, I haven't got to that point yet. I'm still sort of in the process of doing what I can to capture the images. I do feel. I when I look back, you know, sort of through my catalog of images, I've got thousands of images of showing the evolution of the war,
right?
From 22 through to today, and it's a pretty comprehensive and interesting story arc,
uh-huh.
because of the way that the war has changed and evolved.
How has it changed and evolved?
Well, certainly when I was there in 22. There was still a lot of fear that the Russians were somehow going to make a major breakthrough
right.
and sweep through the country. So the entire country was on a war footing. There were literally from east to west, there was no the entire country was on lockdown. There were military checkpoints every 25 kilometers on every highway throughout the country.
Yeah.
You had to be, you know, show your ID, your press pass, just to move around the country. There were, you know, barricades and tank traps and that sort of thing, sort of ready to be pulled across
sure.
every highway at almost every major intersection. As the war evolved, you know, it became clear that the Russians were no longer in a position to be able to sort of ever sort of threaten to sweep through the country sort of blitzkrieg style. So, the situation changed and evolved, so that the west of the country became a little less on guard. There's more normalcy of life in the west, in cities like Odessa and cities like Lviv and Vinnytsia. But the situation in the east deteriorated to the point where cities like Liman, Izum. I can name them all, but just the major cities that are close to close to the zero line are devastated. I mean, the attacks continue. Bakhmut, you know, as we know, Bakhmut, which was and Chasiv Yar, which I was in, these cities have been reduced to rubble.
Hmm.
The villages even more so than the cities, the villages, that these small villages that you pass through between the cities in the east that were either occupied or heavily contested, have ceased to exist. The Russians went through and literally destroyed every single building. There's multiple villages that I've driven through where every single village has been destroyed. And the idea was that the Russians want to make sure that the Ukrainians who have fled these villages have nothing to come back to.
They also planted mines everywhere.
Oh, right? There's mines everywhere. Yeah, that's probably the biggest danger, actually, as a civilian in the combat zone, are mines. There's warnings everywhere. You have to be very careful when you're driving, not to stay on roadways. Don't go off into the verges. Don't. I was with a mine sweeping crew that I just came across by the side of the road that were going through a field, and doing that very dangerous work of looking for.
I remember your photograph of that.
Yeah. You got to be really careful of the mines. The country is tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of mines have been planted. I mean, any time that the Russians were forced out of an area, they would make sure that they mined the entire town before they left. It was, just a way of retribution for being forced out of these cities. The savagery is unconscionable. I mean, I still have trouble understanding or getting my head around the fact that the atrocities that were committed, the murders in the massacres in Bakhmut, in Izum, in Bucha, were not committed by an army that had spent years in the field, suffering and dying and watching comrades being blown apart. These massacres were committed within days and weeks of the invasion. Mm. I just find it hard to understand how the level of hatred that existed for them to be able to get to the point of committing these kinds of atrocities, within days of or within short weeks of launching an invasion. I just don't understand it. Never will.
I don't either. And they've lost like a million men attempting this invasion, right?
Yeah.
And Ukraine has lost 500,000 men or more, right?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I still hear rhetoric about Ukraine's going to lose the war. Ukraine can't survive. Ukraine if the U.S. had invaded Iraq and after 3 years had occupied maybe 20% of the country and lost a million soldiers, do you think that we'd be considered
no.
that we were winning?
No.
Do you think?
So he's trying to make a point. He's trying to wear them down. And I don't know where Trump is headed with respect to that. But.
Trump doesn't understand. He is – I don't want to go on a rant here. But there is no – he has no clue about Putin's motivations, his objectives. Vladimir Putin sees himself in a historical context. He sees himself as the heir to, the throne of Peter the Great. And in the Russian psyche, Ukraine has always been, a lesser country, a lesser region, some place to be exploited. They're not, they're peasants. They're only good for farming. The Ukraine has been looked at as a resource for Greater Russia, as a place where they grow our grain. And there is absolutely no room in Putin's mind to lose a war to the Ukrainians. That is absolutely something that he would throw every last Russian citizen into that quagmire, into that hellscape before he would ever be seen to have lost a war against an entity like Ukraine. There is absolutely no place in his mind where he would allow that to be perceived as having lost that war. So Putin will not stop that war. He will not negotiate a peace with Zelensky because Zelensky to him represents an individual who will never kowtow to him, who will never be, be like a Lukashenko in Belarus, somebody who is who knows his place and will be subservient to Russia. So as long as Zelensky remains as president of Ukraine, he will not negotiate. He will not end this war under any circumstances whereby he will not ever endorse Western troops in Ukraine. Again, all mm-hmm. that's doing is bringing what he perceives to be the enemy closer to his borders, which mm-hmm. is one of the reasons that he launched this war in Ukraine, was to de-Westernize Ukraine, to force Ukraine back under the Russian sphere of influence and away from Europe.
Mm-hmm.
So any of these concepts that are being floated about Putin negotiating with Zelensky and security guarantees that allow Western troops it's a fantasy. It's never going to happen.
So you think he just won't stop fighting until he gets the whole country? What do you predict?
He won't stop fighting until in my prediction, he'll never get the whole country. He just doesn't. I don't think that's he certainly would be able to declare victory if he managed to occupy Kherson, Luhansk, Donetsk, the regions that he's and he doesn't occupy 100% of those yet. He will certainly keep fighting, and would not stop fighting until he loses on the battlefield definitively. And I don't think he would survive that, and I think he knows that. Or until he has achieved objectives where he can declare victory in such a manner as he will be seen to have been the victor. He's not going to stop until one of those two things happens, until he quote unquote wins or until he's forced to stop.
Well, I worry about it because I think March, I think Trump paused U.S. aid to Ukraine.
Yeah, he did temporarily. And it hurt. It wasn't the aid so much as the intelligence sharing that he stopped because the Ukrainian armed forces certainly depend heavily on U.S. Intel in terms of targeting and information getting a view of what's happening on the battlefield, what's happening behind the lines. All of this stuff is critical. I mean, the Ukrainians have done an incredible job. It is a David and Goliath battle, but the creativity and the just the will of the Ukrainian armed forces, they'll be studying it in war colleges for generations.
I know I've seen photos and videos of them in battle from helmet cameras.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen them in their drone factories. Mm-hmm. And you took pictures.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's incredible. I mean, what I saw in May of this year when I was with the Army, it's a tired army. They are tired. They are short of men. They're short of ammunition. But the morale is just as high as it was.
Wow.
There is no flagging of the morale. There is no flagging in their dedication to the cause. And you got to remember, this is not an army of professional soldiers.
Right.
The professional soldiers are clearly still fighting. Most of the professional soldiers are in the elite units. But the majority of the army now is, I was with a sniper unit, four guys. There was a lawyer, a steelworker, a railway engineer, and a ballet dancer. And those were the four guys.
And they had been trained
and
sent out to battle.
Yeah, and I was with a drone unit in May, young woman she was 23 years old. She's a drone pilot. I watched her fly a heavy drone into a Russian energy substation. She piloted in there. And she was a circus trapeze artist.
But she was flying drones.
She was flying drones, yeah.
Wow.
So, and when I talked, I mean, there was a guy, a younger guy, in his 30s. He was a medic in one of the elite medic units, medical that did medevac, medical evacuations. He's a photographer. And I saw he showed me his Instagram. He's probably a better photographer than I am. And it's just, I mean, it's a tragedy that somebody with that kind of talent, you know, has had to put, and as have they all, have to put their civilian identity on hold.
Right.
And take up arms and learn to be killers. But they've done it. And they do it without complaint. The dedication is remarkable. And when I talk to them about what they want to do after the war, nobody will talk about it. Everyone says, that's for another day. That's out of their minds. They're focused entirely on the mission, the job at hand. And any thoughts about what the future might bring is just put out of their heads.
One thing I saw that you said, mm-hmm. and talking about the photographs, mm-hmm. you like to create an encounter experience for the troop, for the viewer,
mm-hmm.
and I love that part. And then you also said, this is important, if the viewer can perceive the consequences of inflicting suffering, maybe they can be more motivated to do something about it. That's one of the results of your photographs, I think.
Yeah, ultimately, that is the goal. The goal is to, my passion is people, is photographing people.
Sure.
I mean, I sometimes photograph events and things, but certainly my intent is to photograph people in such a way as when you're looking at a photograph that you feel like you're in an encounter experience with that individual.
Yes, yes.
That you're able to connect emotionally with that individual, that you in some sense can share a little bit of whatever their experience is, that some of that may come through in the image that I capture. It's an intangible. I don't necessarily know, you know, what that means until it happens, and it's different with everyone I photograph. But my intent is always to be able to capture a portrait of an individual or a scene with an individual in it in such a way as I'm capturing as authentically as possible whatever that person is experiencing at that moment. I don't try to influence. I don't want to, you know, see a reflection of myself in my images. I don't mm-hmm. want to, you know, try and keep my energy out of the photograph.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately the goal is, you know, that somebody might see an image that affects them sufficiently mm-hmm. to either reinforce their, their perspective on what's happening or to change their perspective on what's happening and ultimately to, you know, hopefully stimulate them to take some sort of action to get involved, whether it means, just talking about it to people who perhaps haven't seen the images or haven't mm-hmm. thought about the war or have sort of put it out of their minds because it's no longer headline news necessarily, or to put their hands in their pockets and make a donation to a Ukrainian charity. And mm-hmm. there's many mm-hmm. of them. United Help Ukraine is a great one. I would love to see that, more of that. I would love to, I know that certainly donations to Ukrainian nonprofits have plummeted over the past.
Really?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, they're. I mean, initially, right after the invasion, I mean, it was the coffers were full, and there was an enormous amount
no idea
resources available. Now it's getting more and more difficult. You know, again, people are, have short memories, and they have short attention spans, and the media cycle moves on, and other things happen in the world. Obviously, the tragedy that's happening right now in Gaza that has supplanted
yes.
has sort of has taken the news cycle over. And I'm not saying that what's happening there is a human tragedy of epic proportions.
Of course.
But unfortunately, Ukraine is still going through what Ukraine went through in 2022. Things haven't changed for the Ukrainians. They're still fighting a brutal war against an invasion, an unprovoked invasion and they are in need of as much support and help as they were back in February 2022.
We're talking to Alan Mistel, a photographer who's been to Ukraine 5 times. His website is alanmestel.com, alanmestel.com. We're going to talk a little bit more about that in a minute, but let me tell you that you can be part this Saturday of the live WSL audience when Talk of the Town returns. It's hosted by Carrie Seidman, and it'll be at Fogartyville, 11 a.m. this coming Saturday, October 4th. She'll be joined by Wilkinson Elementary School parent Jody Osceola, Carol Lerner, friend of mine of Support Our Schools, and Sarasota County Board Member Liz Barker. And they'll be talking about school choice vouchers and Schools of Hope charters and the proposed closure of Wilkinson School and what the future holds for the county's A-rated public school system. It's an hour of analysis, debate, and fun with a dash of humor. And we hope you can attend or at least listen on WSLR.org. Doors open at 10:15. No arrivals after 10:45 because we'll be entering a live broadcast situation. We don't want any noise. For more information, just visit WSLR.org or you can call us at 894-6469. And one other thing, before I get that back to Alan Mestel, we're going to be having, on starting October 15th, our fall membership drive to recruit more people to WSLR, to ask them to become members and support our station. October 15th is a Wednesday. I'll be here with Bob Connors. And all it takes is $40 for the year. That's less than $1 a week to help us stay on the air and support these many programs, speakers, and events. At least a third of our revenue comes from donations from listeners like you. And if you appreciate us or Democracy Now!, which follows us at 10 o'clock, please help us out. We're a nonprofit, and every penny counts. That's October 15th. We'll start our membership drive. Oh, wow, that was a wonderful summary of what you do.
Appreciate it.
Alan. Well, anything else you want to talk about? You want to say something about Streets of Paradise?
Sure. I mean, I know it's been news in the community in recent weeks. I mean, Streets of Paradise was an entity that began back in 2018.
Yeah.
I started it with Greg Cruz. It was, I guess, that the founding of Streets of Paradise was kind of a dual track convergence of work that I had been doing and the work that Cruz had been doing.
Uh-huh.
I know Greg had been working with the homeless community and providing resources for them.
Yep.
I had asked Greg if he would, if he wanted to help me with a project that I had wanted to do for some time. It was actually a continuation of something I used to do in Toronto with the United Way. But I wanted to try and bring awareness to the homeless community, mm-hmm. By providing what I call respectful portraiture that would humanize the.
I love it. I love those photos.
Yeah,
me.
Thank you. And and Greg was on board with that, and we went around and Streets of Paradise, the entity that became the nonprofit, started as a website that I put up with the images the project evolved. Greg started doing food shares for the
right.
under the Streets of Paradise name.
Right.
We ended up founding the nonprofit. It was originally intended to be a dual, a dual purpose entity that was going to be both an arts and an outreach entity.
Mm-hmm.
That was in, I think, February 2018. It was, things between Greg and I changed. I think, I don't want to get into the details too much, but certainly, I think Greg expressed that his, I think he failed to continue to see the value in what I was doing with the imagery.
Wow.
And that was fine. I mean, it was a surprise to me. that he felt that way, but you know, it you know, my opinion about Greg hadn't altered. You know, but a working relationship between the two of us became unworkable, and I know Greg went on to continue the work that he was doing with the homeless, and they've done amazing things. I have nothing negative to say about Streets of Paradise, the entity, and what it became, and the work that it did. I think they've done,
and they're still doing.
Yeah, and they still do, absolutely. In terms of what happened recently with Greg, all I can say is I know Susan Nylon. She actually was involved in my very first.
She's the chairman of the board, and yeah. she terminated Greg.
Yeah,
The board did,
and I had known Susan for a few years. She had, as I said, been involved in publicizing my very first trip to Ukraine. I have never had any. I don't have anything negative to say about Susan. She's always been, you know, she's done amazing things for me with my Ukraine effort, and you know, I know that she's been sort of demonized a little bit by certain comments on Facebook, whatever. I believe wholeheartedly that if Susan did what she felt was best for the organization, she did it from a place where she felt that genuinely was the right move to make.
Sure.
And that's really all I have to say about that. I don't know any specifics about what Greg may or may not have done. In terms of what the root causes of the termination were. All I can say is I know Susan, and I don't believe that she had any ulterior motives. Any suggestions of racism or anything of that nature, I think are way out of line.
And the fact that Kathy Bryant remains.
Yeah, I mean, that should tell you.
That says a lot to me.
That should tell you a lot. I mean, she and Greg have been, two peas in a pod for a long time, and the fact that she would remain and should tell you that had it been something that was immoral or went against her sense of
she would have said so.
She would have said so, and I think she would have resigned in protest. So I hope Greg does great things. I know that the guy's got a lot of charisma, he's got a lot of energy, he's done a lot of great in the community, he's got a lot of support, and I'm sure that he will find another way to make a difference. Do I feel as though whatever happened at Streets of Paradise was warranted? Can't say for sure, but I certainly believe that Susan acted with integrity.
Sure, and they're still certainly worthy of our support. They do a lot of good.
I mean, they're doing great. And you know, when Greg and I were first contacted by the Suncoast Partnership to End Homelessness by Tara Booker, who was at the time the acting CEO of the organization. She had us come in, and she was the one that first approached us about filling this need. There was a hole in the structure of the effort to get people rehoused, and that was the furnishing. There were no entities working in the nonprofit sphere at that time that were willing to step up and fill that niche. And she was up front that there was no funding available. That was something that we would, have to figure out how to do. And both Greg and I at the time were very excited about the idea of filling that niche. And look at what Streets of Paradise grew into. I mean, they've done an amazing job of providing really, an essential element of the rehousing puzzle.
Yeah, I didn't realize until I knew about this organization. But when they come off the street into an apartment, basically it's empty.
Yeah,
and Streets of Paradise furnishes it not only with furniture, but photos and dishes and silverware.
Yeah, yeah.
Everything you need to make a home.
Everything. And that is it's a remarkable remarkable work that's been done and will continue to do. And I have full faith that Kathy's going to be capable of continuing to run that organization. I know that Susan was brought in to I guess, pulled together a new board when the entire board resigned in January.
Why did that happen? Do you know?
Well, I mean, I think it was related to the issue with Planned Parenthood and the issue that arose when the Democratic Party were allowed to do fundraising from the Streets of Paradise gallery.
We're not allowed.
They did. Which was, of course, is contrary to the, you know, to
yes.
Yeah. So, yeah, that was so Streets of Paradise were at that point asked to leave the gallery. Because of having allowed the Democratic Party to do fundraising from their space.
Okay.
From what I understand, that caused enough the potential fallout liability from that caused the board to resign, I think, en masse. So there was no board in January, and that's when Susan, who had done consulting with Streets of Paradise, was asked to come on board and form a board. So it wasn't as though Susan was sort of chomping at the bit to try and become chairman of the board of Streets of Paradise. I think she stepped in really to help them out of a difficult situation. So that is just what I've come to understand.
Well, I wish him luck. We've had Kathy on the program many times. Mm-hmm. Well, three or four, and I appreciate what they do. I've donated lots of furniture and lots of dishes, and so I know they've gone to a good use, and they'll keep up their work. We've been talking to Alan Mistel, a photographer whose work is going to be shown in WSLR Fogartyville's house starting in a couple of weeks. October 13th, and I hope you'll come by WSLR Fogartyville to see those amazing photographs. They draw you right in. I have some I cannot forget of those children on the border. I can't get them. I can picture them anytime I want to. They're that riveting. Come see those photographs, and then on October 28th, Greg will be part of a panel of other Ukrainian citizens, American citizens who have Ukraine heritage, and we'll talk about the photographs, the movie called 20 Days in Mariupol, which is amazing in its itself. These photographers were part of the battle, part of the initial phase of the war, and barely got out of the city with their lives. Thank you, Greg, for everything you do. I hope you won't change. I hope you publish a book or a traveling show to let other people see your work. If you want to see some amazing photos, just go to alanmistel.com. And if you have trouble finding that website, just call me up. It's worth many hours of viewing. Any final thoughts, Greg? We've got 3 minutes.
I just encourage people to recognize that Ukraine is still desperately in need of support. Don't necessarily, buy into any revisionist history that may be spouted by the current administration about Ukraine, you know, somehow being partially responsible for what's happening to it. It was an unprovoked invasion by a imperialistic leader of a country that is trying to, you know, has been trying to sort of recreate the Soviet sphere of influence, and saw Ukraine as getting too friendly with the West, and that is the sole reason why Ukraine is suffering through what it's going through right now, and it is a brutal invasion. And we need to support them to every step of the way.
All right. That's Alan Mistel from alanmistel.com, an amazing photographer. I want you to stay tuned now for Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. You can go to their website if you miss it. But it's one of the best sites I know for international news and then United States news as well. Amy Goodman has a new, there's a new movie out about her. We'll be talking about that later. Thank you, Alan. Really appreciate what you do and what you continue to do. Let's see. I think I've got, I've got 40 more seconds.
Yeah, there you go. Well, 40 seconds. What can I say in 40 seconds? Support Ukraine. Resist the resist this administration and as best you can. There's, you know, democracy is in dire straits at the moment, in my opinion. And I think we need to really everybody has to do what they can.
Thank you, Alan. Thank you.
All right.